One of the tools that we use most often, that we're most excited about, is something called oil vulnerability auditing, which is being developed at Liverpool University. And it's a way of engaging the business community, which is really, really key to this, and something environmentalists notoriously haven't been that good at over history. And what it is it's a bottom-line risk management tool. You look at the whole way that the business works, where it uses oil, whether it be for lubrication, transportation, manufacturing, or whatever. You build up a whole picture of how that business works and where it depends on liquid fuels for that. And then you're able to run a model where you say, well, what happens if oil costs $80 a barrel, $90 a barrel, $100 a barrel? And you start to see the vulnerabilities within the business, so you can start to plan ahead. And it's with Totnes is the first town in the UK that's been training people within the community to do this process with local businesses. And we're running 3 pilots at the moment. We've trained up a team of 16 people, and I think that's going to become a very, very powerful part of this whole process. We run a 10-week evening class called Skilling Up for Power Down, which has been very successful. We have a number of working groups on food, arts, liaison with local government, a whole range of those, and they again bring together all the very passionate people on these different subjects. We've started planting nut trees within the town, which is a food security thing and an awareness raising issue as well. We launched something called the Totnes Pound. This is the first Totnes Pound, which we've produced 10,000 of these, and people buy them. They pay £9.50 for 10 Totnes Pounds. There's 70 local businesses who will take this as being worth a pound, and it's been very successful. Tourists love them, the shopkeepers love them, people really enjoy them. What it does is a currency which runs parallel to the national currency, but which can't leak out from the community, so it's locally loyal money. We run a conference called Estates in Transition, bringing together landowners from all around the southwest to look at the implications of peak oil and climate change for how the land around Totnes would be managed and how it can relate into what's happening within the transition town process. We've produced this, which is a local food directory for Totnes, which lists all the local businesses, local agriculture, local suppliers and so on. That's been very, very useful as well for starting to reacquaint people with the local food economy. We do a project called Transition Tales, which is working in local schools, engaging the children in telling stories from a powered-down future, looking back to now. We have started making short films, putting them on YouTube. If you put Transition Town Totnes on YouTube, you'll find a number of films, hopefully this one also. There's a local energy company called Tresco, Totnes Renewable Energy Supply Company, which has formed since the unleashing to start putting in place local energy infrastructure. We've been running World Cafe sessions, think tank sessions with local politicians. We've been running seed exchange days. One of the people within TTT has done fundraising for books within the local library. So there's now £1,500 worth of books on all aspects of sustainability within the local library. What's been really amazing since we started Transition Town Totnes last September is how the idea has gone viral all over the place. So we started last September. Totnes was the only one. There's now over 20 formally stamped transition towns, and there's over 100 other ones around the country and outside the UK as well who are starting this process. So it's something which has gone very, very viral. So hopefully this has given you some kind of a sense of what's happening here in Totnes and within the transition movement. If you want to find out more about the work that I do, you can look at transitionculture.org. For the transition towns movement as a whole, transitiontowns.org is where to look. Just to leave you with one of my favourite quotes, which is from Arundhati Roy, the Indian writer. She says, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." Thank you all very much, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
That was Rob Hopkins of Transition Town Totnes in the UK. I hope you found that as thrilling and inspirational as I did. You're listening to speakers from a panel on Ingredients of Systemic Change from a conference confronting the triple crisis. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN, Nashville. WUOW, Oneonta. KRBS, Oroville. WKNH, Keene. Radio Veronica, U.S. WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton. KSOW, Cottage Grove. Or WMRW, Warren. We return to Megan Quinn, who will introduce the next panelist.
Our next speaker, I'm honored to introduce to you Helena Norberg Hodge. She's an internationally recognized pioneer of the worldwide localization movement and a leading analyst of the impact of the global economy on culture and agriculture specifically. She's fluent in 7 languages and the author of numerous works, including Bringing the Food Economy Home and, of course, the inspirational classic Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh. She's the recipient of the Alternative Nobel Prize, the Right Livelihood Award. She's one of the founders of the International Forum on Globalization and is the director of the International Society for Ecology and Culture. So please welcome Helena Norberg Hodge.
Thank you. I'm very honored and happy to come after Megan, Richard, and my friend Rob. It's wonderful to see so much talk about localization, and I want to keep talking about it and strengthen the notion that it is the systemic shift that we need to make, the central focus of the systemic shift we need to make. But first I want to say that I think we need to add another crisis to our triple crisis. Don't want to depress you too much, but I think it's very important that we talk about a quadruple crisis because we need to recognize the enormous social costs worldwide of this global economy. The social costs include a very frightening demise of democracy, even in my native country of Sweden. And as Vandana was saying last night too, in India, the government is basically rolling out the red carpet to corporations, creating free trade zones, and police are shooting farmers dead who try to resist the process of land grabbing. So we have a very, very serious crisis of democracy. We also have, in the north in particular, in the industrialized world, an epidemic of depression. There are signs everywhere that people are not doing well, and there is particularly a growing awareness about the crisis with children. In the UK, there have been reports in the last year, some of them in the mainstream media used sentences like, "The modern world is destroying our children." We have books in America, like Richard Louv's book, Rescuing Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder, and the catalogue of problems that are emerging because children are deprived of nature. We also have in the South, and I've been witness to this in remote cultures in the western part of the Tibetan Plateau, in Ladakh, in Nepal, and in Bhutan, where I've also worked over a 5-year period, I've seen that the impact of the global economy with its structural changes, which, as Dale Wen was outlining today about China, which acts as a steamroller, destroying rural livelihoods, pushing people into urban slums, basically, where they are suddenly thrown into a desperate competition for scarce jobs. At the same time, the global economy and the global consumer culture is pushing a different identity, essentially a consumer monoculture, as a role model for children worldwide. So there is enormous psychological pressure that leads to self-rejection. And the combination of this psychological pressure, which essentially tell people that they are no good the way they are, and the structural economic pressure that's creating such unemployment and intense competition, the two are responsible for a dramatic increase in local ethnic friction and conflict as different groups find themselves pitted against each other in the new centralized urbanized economic structures. And in the South, as well as in the North, we're seeing a rise in fundamentalism, which also is born of this psychological and economic insecurity. So we have really catastrophic social crises as well that we need to include. And I want to say a little bit more about that, but first to say that in a sense, for me, the good news is that the current oil-based globalizing economy is so disastrous for us as humans that it creates so much unhappiness and friction. The good news then is that in terms of what Rob was saying, we want to paint a picture of that delightful seaside resort, that place we want to go to. Well, we can really explain that we're talking about improving human well-being, particularly the deeper sense of meaning, joy, and connection that comes from community, as Megan was saying. So that we need to understand perhaps first something about the unhappiness and how that is linked to globalization in order to create what I think could, in a very few years, become a very powerful movement for change. A powerful movement for change at the local level as well as urgently, desperately needed policy change. And I think when particularly those middle classes we've been talking about, the middle classes in the West, wake up to their unhappiness and the price particularly that their children are paying, I think we will, and I hope it will happen very soon, that we'll see this very, very powerful and rapid movement for change. And so we need to move in a localized direction. Now, localization is, in contradistinction to globalization, it's about shortening the distances that goods travel, the distances between production and consumption. It is about finance, money, and business being place-based, rooted, localized. This does not mean that every activity is going to take place within a five-minute walk of where you live. It doesn't mean that everything will be village-based, but it does mean in the current order of things that we need to have a vision and a clarity about the need to root business and finance. And that needs to be, to start with, at the level of democratically defined units, in other words, the nation state. The flight into the mobility, the transnational nature of capital and business is the fundamental root problem that we face. And that has led to structures that have become so powerful. The transnational corporations have become so powerful that they can blackmail nation states. And as Annie Leonard's brilliant film showed, I hope you all spread it around, we saw how the most powerful entities are now corporations. That we're talking about a situation where this growth in power means a type of empire, an empire that's out of sight, an empire that we have not been allowed to talk about. But now, of course, with the discussion of globalization, we are seeing more and more of a recognition of the fact that we must deal with the power of transnational corporations. And from my point of view, rooting, localizing is the systemic shift that we need to insist on. That, of course, doesn't mean ending international trade. We're just talking about the actual structures, the business entities, the banking entities, the fact that they need to be reduced in scale and be rooted. We need to be moving, in terms of policy, towards also ensuring that things like food come from much closer to home. As Rob was saying, the cake should come from the region, The cake meaning the basic staples that we need to survive. If we're dependent for those staples on the other side of the world, we are incredibly vulnerable, and we are not exposed enough to the fact that at the moment, I know of no single exception. All governments are pursuing policies now that mean that every day the distances are growing longer, so that the food that you eat, be it in Kenya, be it here in Washington, D.C., be it in the Himalayas, the food that you eat in terms of your daily staples is coming from further and further away as a consequence of economic policies that encourage an increase in international trade as a fundament of growth. I just quickly want to say that this process started very clearly, the sort of first phase of globalization started with slavery, started with conquistadors that imposed on people, forced people away from diversified production for local needs onto monocultures for the powerful elite in the West. Slavery, force, genocide are the background to the current situation we have today. Without that, we could not have this unequal playing field that we have today. But globalization in the second phase, in the development phase, we were fooled into believing that these colonies, the peoples that had been enslaved and forced away from producing for themselves into producing for Europe in the beginning, that in the development era we were told the colonies were now freed and now we had a new turnaround, supposedly, where people were independent and development was going to improve their standard of living, they were going to rise up to the same level as those in the West. And in fact, now when we look back, we see that the second phase of globalization, the development phase, simply meant an economic enslavement. The debt grew and grew. The Bretton Woods institutions ensured that these countries were enslaved economically. Now in the third phase, there are still, unfortunately, many people who believe that the poverty is going to be solved if we open our markets even more widely in the North to products from the South. It is the same formula, it is the same fundamental problem that people have not been allowed to produce a range of products for their own needs as a priority and as the first choice, and to trade where it makes sense. No community would choose to export basic foodstuffs and turn around and import basic foodstuffs from the other side of the world. But because of these structures that have been imposed on people and imposed on the populations of the North as well, we're now in a situation where almost everywhere you go in the world, food from the other side of the world will cost less than food from a few miles away. This is a completely artificial economy. The prices are not reflecting the true costs of the energy, the labor, and in many cases, even the capital that went into producing these products. I studied this phenomenon about 10 years ago, I guess maybe now it's about 15 years ago, around the world, and I found that in Mongolia, where there are 25 million milk-producing animals, and you find the most superb dairy products in every yurt in the rural areas. In Ulaanbaatar, you couldn't even find Mongolian dairy products. They were from Germany. In Kenya, I found Dutch butter costing half as much as Kenyan butter. In Spain, I had witnessed over a decade how the local economy was being destroyed, the local food economy, which was still quite strong even in the early 80s, certainly in parts of Andalusia. This was being destroyed, and you had butter from Denmark, butter from Holland. Spanish butter cost much more. I went to Denmark and found that there I was served French butter in little plastic pots. And in Totnes, in Devon, where I live, the town that Rob is from, we find that butter from New Zealand costs a quarter of the price from the Riverford farm down the road, less than a mile away. So butter from New Zealand costs a quarter. Now, this is not an anomaly. This is not a rare exception. The United States, as of our most recent statistics, which go back a few years now from the book Bringing the Food Economy Home, we found the United States was exporting about 900,000 tons of beef and veal a year. And guess how much they were importing? About 900,000 tons of beef and veal. The UK at that time was exporting about 47 million kilograms of butter and importing about 49 million kilograms of butter. Why? Why is this happening? If around the world, when we ate our daily bread, our staples, from the region, from a multitude of smaller farms and businesses, you know, retailers, processors, farmers, if around the world that's how we consumed our daily bread, no multinational would make a profit.
Helena Norbert Hodge, Director of International Society for Ecology and Culture.
We have with us Josh Farley tonight. He's an assistant professor of community development and applied economics and public administration, as well as a fellow at the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at the University of Vermont. His academic background includes degrees in biology, international affairs, and neoclassical economics. He, together with Herman Daly, authored one of the first textbooks on ecological economics. Josh also is involved in problem-based projects around the world on the practical side, including a lot of international experience, serving as the program director of the Center for Rainforest Studies in Yungaburra, Australia. So please welcome Josh Farley.
I think a lot of people have already presented enough information, so it's pretty clear that one of the driving forces of this triple crisis is our current economic system. It's our economic system that is leading us to dig up the oil, chop down the trees, wipe out the biodiversity, all to feed our demand for ever-increasing consumption. One thing I want to point out about our economic system, the capitalist system, that people tend to neglect is capitalism, the industrial economy emerged hand-in-hand with a fossil fuel economy. If you look at Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, 1776, kind of summarized the philosophy behind the capitalist economy, the theory, and it was about the same time that we actually perfected the steam engine that pumped water out of the coal mines. When we talk about the capitalist economy, we're talking about the fossil fuel economy. The two go hand-in-hand. You know, we've had fundamental changes. We have a fossil fuel economy that's the capitalist economy running out of fossil fuels. We've done all these damage to our systems through this economy. I want to look at a new economic system. How do we design an economic system that achieves what we want, that's based on science and not ideology? Right now, if you take a course in economics, you take that course in the United States, and you are taught that markets are the answer to everything. Any question, the answer is the free market. If you took a course in Marxist economics, you would be taught that social ownership of the means of production is the answer to every question. And it's too rare that economists actually look at what economics is and try to define a system based on what economics is. Economics, simply defined, is the allocation of, or I should say conventionally defined, it's the allocation of scarce resources among alternative desirable ends. How we take what we have to create what we want. And if that's the definition of economics, there's three questions we have to ask. The first of these is, what are the desirable ends? What is it we want? The second is, what are the scarce resources? And only after you've asked those first two questions can you even begin to decide what system you use for allocation, whether it's capitalism, whether it's some kind of democratic decision-making process, or whether it's Marxism or social ownership of the means of production. So we tend not to ask those questions. So if we're looking then at what are the desirable ends, the first question, I think most economists would agree that it's a high quality of life for this and future generations. I would say part of a high quality of life is sustainability. We want future generations to be counted. Justice, we want a just distribution of the resources. We want to feel good that we're not getting our consumption and meeting our needs by harming others. I think we should look at health, education, and simply happiness, satisfaction with life as a whole. I think these are some of the key goals we should be striving for. Conventional economists say that humans are insatiable. We just want more and more and more forever, and as a result, to meet the desirable ends for an economic system is ever-increasing economic growth. So the conventional goal is ever-increasing growth, and we have to look at what extent is that an effective solution to the problem. And first of all, to ask, though, are we insatiable? And I think it's important to remember, for 90% of human history, at least 90%, we were hunter-gatherers. And we needed to, you know, we followed animals that were nomadic. We consumed plants, and when we exhausted them locally, we had to move on. And if you think what it would be like, you know, the hunter-gatherers, they would walk 25, 30 miles a day. And you can't do that if you have a lot of possessions. How far could you go carrying all your possessions? 25 feet would be an amazing feat. So we say it's human nature to always want to accumulate more, yet for hunter-gatherers, if they accumulated more, it kept them from pursuing their food supply, and they died. Accumulation meant death. So we've got to right away discard this idea that we just have unlimited wants. That's not part of human nature. So what we have to look at then is, in this pursuit of endless economic consumption, what has happened? People have already brought up a lot of these statistics, but they do this world value survey, and they ask people in different countries around the world, you know, how happy are you with your life as a whole, and how satisfied are you with the life as a whole? And what you see in that poor countries, people are often not very happy, but as income climbs to about, you know, $6,000 to $10,000 per person per year, we get this plateau. After that, continual increases in wealth do almost nothing for us. And we see that's why, as people have said, Annie Leonard, I think, pointed out, since the 1950s, Americans haven't gotten happier. We've actually gotten less happy in spite of increasing our levels of consumption several fold. So we see that there's, and if you look at it across countries, you know, increased economic production does very little to make us happier or more satisfied beyond a point. You can also correlate it to health and education. And beyond a fairly low level, increased GNP does very little to improve our health, education, happiness, quality of life as a whole. But so we've been very intently pursuing that. So we can look at what we call diminishing marginal benefits of growth. And at the same time, we see serious rising marginal costs. You see enormous increases in CO2 emissions. You see, there's a friend of mine, Brian Check, has done this work that shows what he does is he plots the number of endangered and threatened species against GNP, and you see almost a perfect correlation. As we consume more and more, as we appropriate more and more net primary productivity for ourselves, the rest of the species have less and less. If you look at the work on the global ecological footprint, you see that we surpass the carrying capacity of the planet and continue. Now we are using capital rather than interest. We need to survive on the interest provided by nature, not depleting the capital itself, but we're well into the capital depletion. So what we've seen is diminishing marginal benefits to growth, increasing marginal costs. We've entered an era of uneconomic growth where the costs outweigh the benefits. And I think Yogi Berra summed this up very nicely when he said, we might be lost, but we're making great time. And so we are totally lost. We're following the wrong goal. And unfortunately, we are making excellent time. So I think we can pretty realistically say that this desirable end of increasing economic growth is not where we want to go. But let's look at the scarce resources. What are the scarce resources we have at our disposal to create what we do want? And what we have at our disposal, we live on a finite planet. And it's ruled by the laws of physics. One law of physics is you can't create something from nothing. Every single thing our economic system produces is a transformation of raw materials provided by nature. Another law of economics, which is basically the same thing, is you can't create nothing from something. So after we have transformed those raw materials provided by nature into something our economy consumes, those things break down, wear out, fall apart, return to nature as waste. And there is another law of physics that it takes energy to do work. It is impossible to do any work without energy. Everything we produce requires energy, which currently means fossil fuels. And every time we burn fossil fuels, we emit more waste into the environment. Now if we turn to the laws of ecology, those raw materials we convert into economic production alternatively serve as the structural building blocks of ecosystems. And structure generates function. And those functions that structure generates includes life support functions of our ecosystems. It's regulation of the climate. It's protection from UV radiation by the ozone layer. It's regulation of our water supplies, control of floods. It's regulation of our atmospheric gases. It's these life support functions required for our survival. And you need those structural building blocks of ecosystems to provide those life support functions. There's something else I haven't mentioned in terms of scarce resources that's critically important. That's information, human knowledge. How do we transform things into what we want? How do we protect nature? How do we create an economic system that doesn't destroy the capacity of the earth to sustain life? That requires knowledge, information. And more than ever, information is needed to help solve these problems we're confronting. So if we've looked at then at the desirable lens of the scarce resources, we need to understand a few more things about scarce resources. We want to understand their physical characteristics. We've got to build an economic system that's based on the physical characteristics of resources, not on our assumptions about how to allocate. And one thing that's very important, a lot of resources, they're kind of competitive in their use. Economists call these rival resources, but the way to think of it is we have to compete for their use. If I consume the resource, it's not available for you to use. Oil is a perfect example. If I pump up a barrel of oil and I burn it, you can't pump up and burn that same oil. So we're going to compete for it somehow. Market economics is based on competition. And so that's one way to compete. Another way is to go invade other countries and take their resources. But most of the structural building blocks of nature have this characteristic that if I use it, you can't. I use a tree for building a house, you can't use it to build furniture. I eat a fish, you can't eat it. So those are the resources that, you know, we compete for use. They fit more or less into a market economy, and I'll get back to that in a minute. But there's another class of resources where there's no competition for use. And we really want to cooperate in the use of these. The economic term is non-rival. Means if I consume the resource, it's still available for you to consume. And these are things, if I benefit from a stable climate to raise my garden, there's no less stable climate for you. If I benefit from the ozone layer to keep me from getting skin cancer, there's no less ozone layer for you. This is true for most ecosystem services. I live in Burlington below a nicely forested watershed. That forested watershed prevents the rivers from flooding. Your rain comes down, hits the canopy, breaks into a mist, is absorbed into the ground. It's all nicely aerated by the trees. And that prevents my house from flooding, but that doesn't leave less flood prevention for anybody else. So this is an interesting type of resource that, you know, that I can use it, you still can use it, so there's no reason to compete for it. We should provide it cooperatively. But perhaps even more important is the resource of information. Information actually improves through use. If I use it and you use it, you can build on it and make it better and return it to me better. So this is a really important thing. These are the types of things that should be produced through cooperation. And I will give you an example. We have this ideological belief in the United States that everything should be based on market production. We should have markets in everything. So we've created markets in information, intellectual property rights. Not that many people realize, but last year, the ozone hole had the worst thinning ever. And people think, well, we had the Montreal Protocol. That stopped that problem. But in the Montreal Protocol, it said that India and China could continue to use HCFCs until 2016. They could continue to increase the rate of use and then stabilize till 2044. HCFCs are only 5% as bad as chlorofluorocarbons in terms of ozone depletion. But India and China, as they've gotten wealthier, everybody wants air conditioning and refrigeration, so their use has skyrocketed. So as a result of their skyrocketing use, we now have this record thinning of the ozone hole, of the ozone layer, that's going to become even worse. And why is that? We have non-ozone depleting compounds. We have compounds that don't harm the ozone layer at all, but they're patented. We are using intellectual property rights to prevent the Indians and Chinese from using them. So, you know, we've essentially said if they don't use them, it's going to destroy our economy, it's going to destroy the world, but for the sake of profits, it's the suicidal pursuit of profits. We're not allowing them to use something that's essential for them to use to save ourselves. The same is true if we look at alternatives to oil production. Oil, if I use it, you can't. The alternatives tend to be renewable energy. It's information-based. We develop some ideas about how to capture solar energy. I capture that. There's still solar energy available for you to capture. But if we do this under a market economy, if we have competitive use of information, I'm going to patent that, And I'm not going to let India and China use that information about how to, you know, decentralize clean renewable systems, patent it. If they try to use it, we'll punish them. So they'll continue to burn coal, and we will continue to get global climate change. So it's this obsession. This is a physical characteristic of a resource. It's not, you can't change that. And it determines whether or not we should have competitive allocation or cooperative allocation. So that's one characteristic I think we have to take into account. Another characteristic is it's what we call excludability. Can you own a resource? If I can own something, I can own a barrel of oil. I can prevent you from using it unless you pay me. We have markets in the resource. So you need this characteristic for markets to work. If I can't own something, I can't sell it. Markets won't provide it. So a lot of things like climate stability, the benefits from biodiversity, most ecosystem services, they have this characteristic. I can't own those. If I am an owner of a watershed above Burlington and I say, geez, you know, those people down there benefit from me keeping it forested, I'm only going to provide flood protection for those who pay me. You can't do that. Everybody gets to use it or nobody. And a lot of resources have that characteristic, and markets don't provide those. They don't care about those. They won't put money into preserving them, into restoring them, or into providing them. And these are the ecosystem services. These resources that have that characteristic of not being able to own and of my use doesn't leave less for you, those are the resources that have become the scarcest. Those are the ones that are most important that we really need to focus on protecting and preserving. And market systems totally fail to do that. So what we've done is, as our market system has been phenomenally successful at converting ecosystem structure into consumer goods, and the market system works somewhat for allocating that ecosystem structure, it's been so successful that we've depleted so much structure, now we're threatening those ecosystem services that don't fit into the market model. So we really need to design a new economic system that deals with those resources that can't be owned and that my use doesn't leave less for you. So the conventional economic problem has always been, how do we take those raw materials provided by nature, those resources provided by nature, and turn them into the highest value end products? That's what we call the economic problem. And the market does okay with that. One problem is that what is the highest value end products? We decide how to use those resources based on $1, one vote. You know, for those of us who like democracy and democratic systems, that's not a very appealing system. You have no say in how to use resources if you have no money. That's one problem with it. The other problem with the capitalist system is there's no when-to-stop rule. There's nothing that says, well, what's the correct amount of these raw materials to turn into consumer goods, and how much should we instead leave behind for providing ecosystem services? There's no decision rule in conventional economics that focuses on that. So if we want to develop a sustainable economic system, this macro allocation problem has to be the big question. How much of that ecosystem structure do we convert into economic output? It's the raw materials from economic output. Economic output is essential for our survival. We need to convert some. But how much do we convert into economic output, and how much do we leave intact to provide the life support functions of intact ecosystems? And that is a problem that the conventional economic system can't answer. But it's become the most pressing problem. So if our economic system is incapable of allocating our scarcest, most precious resources, the system has to be reformed. Markets can't make that system. The decision has to rely on democratic principles, and it's a cooperative decision. We all consume the same amount of climate stability. We should decide together how much that is. We all consume the same amount of water regulation, of ozone layer. So those are, and I would argue that if we're going to try to make those decisions, the mechanism, the allocative mechanism, should be based on democracy, one person, one vote, rather than plutocracy, $1, one vote. So we also want to look at, that's the sustainable part of economics. We also want a just economic system. I think we have to look at this notion of reclaiming the commons. Resources provided by nature or provided by society as a whole belong to all of us. Exxon made $46 billion in profits on the price because oil prices went up. Exxon didn't work harder or do any more. It was a resource provided by nature that they captured all the value from. We have to take that back. That $46 billion belongs to us, not to them. And so decisions over macro allocation is how much of that nature to convert to economic output, how much to remain intact. That has to be a community-based decision. Decisions over waste emissions, decisions over resource depletion, decisions over who gets to use the airwaves, those have to be made by community. A few quick things. So if we're going to develop a new ecosystem, I mean a new economic system, we've got to address this triple crisis. And you've seen a lot of doom and gloom scenarios. We've got a power down, 80% reduction now, you know, 95% reduction in the future. How doom and gloom a scenario is it to really change our lifestyle to be sustainable? And I just did a quick back of the envelope calculation. In 1969, we consumed one-third as much per capita as we do today. Today, we're twice as efficient using energy. And as a back-of-the-envelope calculation, that suggests that we could reduce our energy output by 83% and sustain a 1969 standard of living in this country. Of course, since 1969, most of the increase in wealth has gone to the wealthiest, the richest. So for most of us, it would mean we could live better than your average 1969 person if we had a more equal distribution. And that's not that nasty a scenario. You know, people weren't living in misery back then. The poverty rate was lower. And there's other measures of economic welfare, one called a genuine progress indicator, which kind of takes kind of leisure time. That actually peaked in 1969. So if I can have about another 1 minute, I would say, how do we get there? I think the biggest issue is we got to change the paradigm, the way we view the world. Instead of viewing the economic system as something that can grow forever using resources provided by nature, we've got to view the economic system as a subset of the sustaining and containing global ecosystem. You change the paradigm, suddenly continuous economic growth seems impossible. And macro allocation is the central problem. We've got to change our goals. We've got to develop a shared vision of what we actually want our society to look like. Is our goal to double consumption every generation? Or is our goal to have, you know, to have a just society with enough for people? I think if we change this goal away from economic growth, we recognize that continuous economic growth is undesirable. I think the doom and gloom scenario wins fewer converts than painting the nice pictures that people have been talking about here. And just very quickly, I think a third thing, we change the rules. We have democratic control over the commons and the problem of macro allocation, cooperative provision and management of these non-rival resources, the ones that aren't worn out through use, and a just distribution of resources provided by nature and society. And there's a million more things to say, but in 15 minutes, that's about it.
Josh Farley, Assistant Professor in Community Development, Applied Economics and Public Administration at the University of Vermont. He's a pioneer of ecological economics. He was speaking at Confronting the Triple Crises, Climate Change, Peak Oil, Global Resource Depletion, and Species Extinction, a conference convened by the International Forum on Globalization in September 2007. You can contact them at ifg.org. We'll conclude the program with another installment in the reading of the book Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. In our reading last time, Rosenthal critiqued sham democracy, in which elected leaders ignore the desires of the majority of the people, such as by starting wars or by bailing out Wall Street bankers, for example, in order to serve the interests of the ruling class. Class society, she wrote, severs the link between power and responsibility. Those with the most power take no responsibility, while those with the least power are saddled with the most responsibility. Authorities shirk responsibility for the catastrophic outcomes of their actions or lack thereof, but hypocritically hold citizens to a higher standard. Class society violates the basic right to decide what happens to you. Politicians launch wars that other people's children will fight. Employers authorize the use of toxic materials that other people will handle or eliminate livelihoods of people who have no say in the matter. Public officials decide how to respond to disasters in which other people risk their lives, homes, and loved ones. We resume as she asks the question, reform or revolution? Is revolution necessary, or can gradual social improvements result in fundamental social change? In 1900, Rosa Luxemburg addressed this question in Reform or Revolution. Luxemburg compares the struggle to reform capitalism with the labor of Sisyphus, a mythical character who was condemned by the gods to push a boulder uphill only to have it roll back down again. Likewise, people struggle for many years to win reforms, only to see them rolled back or abolished. This back-and-forth movement occurs because the state grants reforms to undercut rebellion, then revokes reforms to promote greater profits, which provokes more rebellion. Britain's welfare state was created to stabilize the system in response to workers' revolts after World War II. As a conservative member of the British Parliament warned, if you don't give the people the reform, they are going to give you revolution. The best-known American reforms, the New Deal, were a response to the Great Depression. Howard Zinn explains, the Roosevelt reforms had to meet two pressing needs: to reorganize capitalism in such a way as to overcome the crises and stabilize the system, also to head off the alarming growth of spontaneous rebellion in the early years of the Roosevelt administration, organization of tenants and the unemployed, movements of self-help, and general strikes in several cities. The ruling class prefers reform to revolution. Once social control is restored, the drive for profit takes priority, and the reform boulder is kicked back down the hill. Today, most of the reforms won in the 1930s and in the 1960s have been lost, or are in danger of being lost, so that it seems like we are back at the beginning. Is it possible to win enough reforms to push that boulder over the top of the hill and create an entirely different society? In 1970, a popular movement in Chile elected a reform government headed by President Salvador Allende, who outraged the capitalist class when he moved to nationalize industry, tax profits, and stop foreign debt payments. In 1973, a U.S.-backed military coup toppled Chile's government, murdered Allende, and imposed a military dictatorship under General Augusto Pinochet. Thousands of people were slaughtered in the wave of terror that followed. The tragedy of Chile proves that the capitalist class will not surrender control over society in response to any vote. On the contrary, it will throw every law out the window to protect its power and its profits. Some people say that Allende moved too quickly. However, it is absurd to think that the tiger will not devour those who extract his claws more slowly. Allende's mistake was that he relied too much on the rule of law and not enough on the power of workers who were begging him for arms to defend the government. Another mistake was to forget that capitalism is an international system. When any group of capitalists is threatened, the rest view this as an attack on their class, and they suspend their rivalry to defend their class. The working class must also defend itself as a class. Mass support for Chile's reforms within the American working class could have blocked U.S. military intervention. Not all reformers are murdered. Some are incorporated into the state to prevent revolution. This happened in Poland in 1989. Lech Walesa was a leader in Solidarity, the mass workers' movement that toppled the ruling Communist Party. After he was elected president of Poland, Walesa turned against the working class, dismantling the welfare state and promoting corporate control of industry. Capitalism offers two options to elected reformers: play by our rules or end up like Allende. There are temporary exceptions. Mass support has kept Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez in office, despite repeated efforts to depose him. Venezuela is an oil-rich nation. As long as oil prices remain high, Chavez may be able to meet the basic demands of Venezuela's workers and most of its capitalists. When oil prices fall, or when the economy goes into recession, Chavez will be forced to choose which class to support. Does that mean that reforms are useless? Not at all. Luxembourg argued that the struggle for reforms as the primary goal cannot transform society. To do that, the struggle for reforms must be waged as a means to revolution, where each reform is clearly linked with the aim of putting the working class in power. The distinction is important. The road of reform never challenges the basic rules of capitalism: seize the surplus and compete or die. In contrast, the Road of Revolution uses reforms as stepping stones to socialism, building the confidence of ordinary people to take control of society. To travel the road to reform, one must lobby politicians, win influence in high places, and get people out to vote. On this road, the ordinary person is a bystander or a cheerleader backing the hired guns. To travel the road to revolution, one must mobilize people at work, at school, and in the neighborhood to struggle on their own behalf. On this road, ordinary people take center stage. The more people organize, the more they can win. Reformers who go hat in hand to the people in power must forever settle for crumbs. In 2005, the World Health Organization admitted that it had failed to meet its goal of providing drug treatment for millions of poor people with AIDS. According to Dr. Jim Yong Kim, director of WHO's HIV/AIDS department, quote, "All we can do is apologize." Had he been outraged and demanded that national leaders cough up the money, or that drug companies provide free medicines, he would have antagonized the people the WHO depends on. Because reforms must be granted by those in power, reformers must continually compromise in the hopes of getting what they want down the road. That road is endless and discouraging. As Dr. Kim stated, quote, "I have to say that I'm personally extremely disappointed in myself and in my colleagues because we have not moved quickly enough. We have not saved enough lives," close quote. In contrast, socialists link every struggle with the aim of taking over the bakery and are not deterred from their goal regardless of whether they win or lose a particular crumb. When socialists win a reform, they celebrate their victory and plan the next one. When they lose a reform, they learn from their experience and double their determination to end this heartless system. Despite countless disappointments, reformism, the belief that gradual improvements will lead to fundamental social change, is kept alive by hatred of the system, combined with the belief that there is no alternative. Capitalism has convinced the majority that revolutions only put new tyrants in power. And many who agree that revolution is necessary will argue that one should fight for reforms in the meantime. Whenever I hear this phrase, I think about a patient dying from blood poisoning and the doctor saying, "She needs antibiotics, but I will give her aspirin in the meantime." No amount of aspirin will cure blood poisoning, and no amount of reforms will transform capitalism. Like Malcolm X said, quote, "It is impossible for a chicken to produce a duck egg. The system in this country cannot produce freedom for the Afro-American. It is impossible for this system, this economic system, this political system, this social system, this system, period." Close quote. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. One big union? Because it controls the production of goods and services, the capitalist class can impose its rules on society, seize the surplus, and compete or die. By taking charge of production, the working class can impose its rule on society, share. How could this be accomplished? The battle for control over production is waged in every workplace every day. When bosses insist that what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine too, seize the surplus, workers have no choice but to fight back. When they don't feel confident enough to fight openly, they fight secretly, taking home, quote, company property, damaging equipment, and committing acts of minor sabotage. The more organized workers are, the more confidence they feel to challenge the boss. Because unions organize workers in self-defense, some people think that unions can be a force for revolution. In 1905, American socialists and anarchists, she leaves that out, and trade unionists launched the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. Their aim was to organize the working class into one big union, call a general strike, shut down capitalist production, and restart it under workers' control. It was a great plan with a fatal flaw. In every workplace, people have political differences, so that conflict results when anyone raises an issue like abortion, immigration, or war. To prevent endless disagreements and divisions, the IWW rejected political discussion, insisting that the economic battle was all that mattered. However, problems don't go away because you ignore them. Workers are bombarded by the ideas of the ruling class, including the idea that there is no alternative to capitalism. By boycotting political discussion, the IWW was unable to counter ruling class ideas that maintain social control. Unions are organizations of reform, not revolution. Their function is to defend workers' rights within the system, not to transform the system. Each union concentrates on improving conditions, one contract at a time, in one workplace or one industry. Originally based on specific trades and then specific industries, unions divide the working class into different and sometimes competing unions, often within the same workplace. Furthermore, union officials perform a management function that makes them hostile to revolutionary change. The cowardice and betrayal of union officials have prompted groups of workers to build democratic organizations inside their unions. A good example is Soldiers of Solidarity inside the United Auto Workers Union. In Democracy is Power, Rebuilding Unions from the Bottom Up, Mike Parker and Martha Gruel write, "Let's be clear, the goal of our movement is not just bigger unions. It's for working people to function as human beings, not bootlicks, not cogs. Starting with our jobs, where we spend most of our waking hours. When we leave our jobs at the end of the day, we should be as healthy as when we started. We should be able to look at the next day and our retirement years with a feeling of security, not dread. Our larger goal is for workers to exert power collectively in the workplace and society, and for that, you need much more than bigger unions. You need powerful workers." Close quote. Achieving this kind of power requires union members to organize across unions in workers' councils. This step is crucial, not only to fight the bosses and the union bureaucrats, but to lay the foundation for a worker-run society. Public or common. People living in pre-class societies had no concept of property. They had personal use items, and everything else was shared. No one owned the land, the water, the forest, the animals, or the knowledge that had been accumulated through generations. All this changed with class society. Those who seized the surplus claimed it as their private property for their exclusive use. Today, the term private property commonly refers to personal use items, your house and car, as well as to the means of production, land, water, science, technology, factories, offices, machinery, etc. This book uses the term private property to mean only the means of production, not personal property. People have always had personal use items and will always have them, regardless of the type of social system. The important question is who owns or controls the means of survival, the means of production. Under capitalism, a distinction is made between private and public property, where private property is owned by a capitalist or group of capitalists, and public property is owned by the state. Because the state claims to represent the people, state or public property is assumed to be the property of the people or common property. It is not. Common property cannot be owned. Common property is no one's property. It is not property at all. It cannot be bought or sold, and its use is democratically determined by ordinary people, the way it was in pre-class societies. And I've been reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue with another reading from the book next week. In the meantime, you can access the entire book on the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Thank you for listening.